The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I have a topic for today, but I don't know how to get into it. You know, it's one thing to know to have a topic, another thing to know how to find your way into it. So perhaps to introduce it, maybe could say that it's about what this Buddhist practice is all about. What's it about? Many people want to know what it's about. Some people don't care what it's about. All they care about is what they're about. And they use practice to find that out. But what is it? What's Buddhism about? And now there's many ideas about what Buddhism is. And there is a tendency in religious circles, including Buddhist circles, to people to be a little bit, perhaps occasionally, attached to what they think is true. And part of this attachment to what is true is sometimes takes the form of believing there's one way, and that one way is the right way, and I have the right way, and everybody else is wrong. And when you enter into Buddhist practice, I don't know if it makes sense to talk about a one way or a true way, and it's or the truth in some categorical way, too much. It's pretty easy to point to things in Buddhism that might fit that kind of category. But it's all too easily does a disservice to the tremendous diversity of human beings and all the different ways that human beings are finding their path. People are many different issues in their life they have to face. People are, in a sense, at different stages of development, psychological development. People have different challenges in their lives. Some have bigger than others. There are minds that operate in different ways. And to assume that every mind operates just like yours, not that you're unusual, but that there's, you know, just like there's many shoe sizes, there might be many, not brain sizes, mind sizes, but many different ways that the mind operates. And so, you know, for just a simple thing is some minds seem to think much more in words. Other minds seem to think much more in images. Some people are much more connected to the logic and rational part of their mind. Some people function much more through their emotional body and their emotions, sense of emotions. Some people are, you know, they say are introverts, some people are extroverts. There's many different kind of personality differences. And so depending on the different aspects of the mind, people, you know, the way their Buddhist practice might unfold or develop could be different. So this idea there's one way, or even just one practice, you know, this is the right practice or the true practice, I think it can do a disservice to a lot of people. There is a famous discourse. Let me back up a little bit. So some of you know the word karma. And before Buddhism, there was seemingly a tradition in ancient India that the word karma didn't mean any kind of action at all. It kind of means action, but not just what it explicitly meant was ritualized action, kind of sacred action. And so it involved, you know, doing the Brahmins would do these particular rituals in order to satisfy the gods and. Or satisfy the creative powers of the world or something. And so get things lined up in a cosmic way in order to get the rain for the crops or long life or fortune or whatever it is that you know, you kind of wanted. And so there was a kind of feeling, idea, that only by behaving in a ritual way could you somehow hope to influence the course of your well-being and happiness. So this praying ritual, so karma was the kind of action. And what was what some people, scholars have pointed out, that what was unique about the Buddha, one of the things that was unique about him was that he took this idea of karma, which meant kind of ritual action, and redefined it. He still kept the word in his system of religion, so karma is a big, important word in Buddhism, but he redefined it so it no longer meant ritual action, physical actions you do, But rather, he defined it very clearly in one passage where he said, "What I say, karma is intention." That he, the karma that he was talking about was internalized. Rather than external action, it had to do with internal action, what goes on in your mind. So this idea of the ethics of your own mind, the quality, the integrity of your own mind, became much more important than actually what you do. And so this played out many times in the discourses of the Buddha, where the Buddha was somewhat critical of the caste system in ancient India. And so there, you know, there was basically, there's many castes, but it's basically four. And there was the Brahmins, which were the high caste. And the Buddha said, oh, what makes a Brahmin is not that you're born a certain way, not that your color is a certain way, your skin, but rather what makes you a Brahmin is the quality of your character, the quality of your heart, the internal way that you are. And so the Buddha would, someone who was in the untouchable class, Buddha would call a Brahmin if they lived with integrity, if they lived with virtue, if they lived had this inner goodness that came forth. So to the Buddha, it was kind of an interior reference for the religious life that became important. And so what's the nature of that interior life? When we, you know, how do we take care of ourselves? How do we, what are we to do with this interior psychological life? What's the path? And this is where I think that it depends on the issues of any individual person's life, what's going on. So this is where I wanted to say that there was a discourse that in the ancient, it's preserved from the ancient time, where the Buddha's disciple Sariputta talks to another disciple who's quite highly respected for his wisdom. And the Buddha says, Sariputta says to this monk, do you live the holy life, do you live the religious life for the purification of virtue? And the man says, no. Do you live the holy life, the purification of your mind? No. Do you live the holy life, the purification of doubt? No. Do you live the holy life for the purpose of realizing what is the path and what is not the path? No. Do you practice the holy life for the sake of knowledge and vision of engaging in the path? No. Do you follow the holy life for the purposes of knowledge and vision in some big, important way of seeing into the nature of life and yourself? And he said, no. And so then Sariputta said, well, what are you doing this for? and the monk responds, I do it for the attainment or the experience of Nibbana, of Nirvana. But Nirvana is an interesting word, because many times in the sutta, what's translated into English as Nirvana or Nibbana, as if it's a noun, is really a verb. It's an activity, and it's a verb that means to release, to let go of, to unbind. So, like if a knot is tied, you untie the knot. If you have shackles and you're bound, then you release the shackles. If you are clinging, there's the release, letting go of the clinging. And so Nibbana is this very important movement, interior movement of releasing something, of being free, being set free. And that's the purpose of the holy life. But the list is quite interesting. So if it's not because what I see is that different people, different stages of their life, might be needing to address some of the different things that the monk said, not for that purpose. So there are people for whom the most important thing that they need to do in their life at a given time is what in this place is called the purification of virtue. They need to somehow clean up their act. And there are some people in our society that spend a lot of time doing that. I have a lot of respect for AA. And in AA, they spend a lot of time cleaning up their act. It's a big deal, and sometimes it takes a lot of time to kind of go around and make amends and apologies and kind of do what needs to be done to kind of clean up your act. But to start living with integrity, what does it take to become a person of integrity? A person who doesn't lie, a person who doesn't steal, doesn't harm other people, doesn't take advantage of people, doesn't lord over people, Many aspects of integrity that some people feel like this is the most important thing they can do at this juncture in their life, is to really deal with, look at that. I've known people who've tried to go on retreat, and because their integrity was so poor, there was such, usually it was just a major thing that they did or something, that it actually didn't make sense for them to be on retreat. Because they couldn't be on retreat because it was just, it's like retreat, someone sitting still and being quiet, showed them their lack of integrity kind of in such a full-blown way that, you know, just meditation didn't make any sense. What made sense was to leave the retreat and deal with this issue, kind of change what's going on. So sometimes the purification of virtue, the cultivation of integrity, is the growing edge of some people's lives. It might not be the final thing that the Buddha was pointing to, but for some people that's what needs to happen and develop. Maybe meditation is not really that important. Beautiful story I liked from many years ago. I was teaching a class to some people who were kind of senior Zen students, kind of a Buddhist class to them. And then I invited in this woman who was not a Zen student, but was a very devout Buddhist. And I thought, oh, she might be nice for having her in the class. She was very committed. She was studying Buddhism at Stanford. So she was, you know, serious about her Buddhism. She had been a lawyer and left that behind in order to do Buddhist studies at Stanford. And I asked her if she meditated, because she was, you know, she'd left law, she'd gone to Buddhist studies, Buddhism was becoming her life. And I said, you meditate? And she said, no, not yet, I'm preparing myself. And this idea that you're preparing yourself was kind of outside of my worldview, because the way I was introduced to Buddhism is you just jump in. I was 19 or 20, and someone said, you know, why don't you go meditate? And so I said, sure. And the idea that you prepare yourself for it was a foreign idea. But I had so much respect for her. She was so devout, and she had so much respect for the inner practice of meditation, the path, and what it entails, that for her it was something you approached with a certain degree of reverence and care and devotion, which meant you prepared yourself for that. I think she was trying to clean up her act in some way. So then the second of these things that the monk, that he was not doing as the ultimate goal of his practice, was the purification of the mind. And so, you know, it doesn't take a lot for some of us to see that our mind is out of control, or that our mind is fractured or fragmented, or that we have psychological challenges in our mind, or we have unresolved resentments and issues and fears that are really kind of obsessing us or grabbing us. And so something has to happen with our neurosis, our strong emotional responses and reactions to the world. And so, you know, it's a pretty impressive how many people in our life, in our world, have psychological challenges of one thing or other. I think it's important to be very respectful of that. There was a cartoon many years ago of this big auditorium, you know, drawing this huge, huge auditorium. In the auditorium, there were two people sitting kind of far apart from each other, otherwise completely empty auditorium. And above the seats, there was a banner that said something like "Children of Functional Families of America." You know, you can maybe it wasn't that exactly, but you know, you get the idea. You know, people with no psychological problems, you know, at whatsoever. And you know, most people have some kind of challenge. And so sometimes it's okay to put them, you know, basically put them aside and not pay much attention to them. They're not so big. And sometimes they're huge for people. The number of people in our society that, I just go through the list of, 20% of the population is depressed. A huge percent of women have been sexually abused. A lot of men have been sexually abused. People have had all kinds of horrible childhoods. People have been in accidents. People have, lost loved ones, in all kinds of ways. It just goes on and on the list of challenges people have had to face. And these challenges sometimes sit in our minds in a way that make them really heavy or closed or tight or there's kind of a struggle or inner conflicts that are there. There's not just a lot of people who have conflict with themselves. They're at war with themselves, and they've internalized messages from their family or society about who they are and how they're wrong or bad or something. There was a I hope you should look it up. It was in this, I saw it Sunday. It was on Yahoo kind of news. There was a commencement speech given in Massachusetts for a high school last week. And that title of the commencement speech was, "You Are Not Special." And so you should go, you know, look it up. "You Are Not Special," commencement speech, high school. And he goes through and he tells all these high school students, you're not special. And he explains very logically, very clearly, why you're not so special. It's usually the opposite, right? But when you overemphasize how everyone's special, you give actually people the wrong impression, because then there's kind of this whole self-esteem movement that has sometimes been played out in America, has led to a lot of people who feel privileged and deserving of success, and then they're surprised when things aren't easy for them, because they were led to believe they were special and everything should be, you know, easy for them. So I'm trying to give you a sense of the many different things that where the mind is fractured or hurt or tight or struggles. And so then there's a purification of the mind. And generally in Buddhism, that's associated with concentration practice. Concentration practice here means meditation practice that helps stabilize the mind from being agitated and spinning. But more than just stabilize, begins to heal the fragmentation, heal the divisions in the mind, help somehow to calm down the heart. So it begins feeling whole again and complete. So this purification of mind, heart, makes it whole and complete, settles down, unites what's been fragmented. And for some people, that's the important step of stage of their practice. For some people, that's relatively easy. For some people, that takes years and years. For some people, meditation practice is not going to do it. And they can't just depend on meditation to create what in this list is called purification of mind. But maybe they need to do therapy or actually do some other things. Or maybe they need to go out and get a job for a while. Because, having work sometimes for some people is very healing, very meaningful to let something mature and settle. So then the next one is the purification of doubt. And so some people have, at some point, have existential issues. Maybe they're healed enough, they're settled enough, their life is taken care of enough, so that they have the basic needs satisfied. And then at some point there's this, can be existential doubt or existential issues that come up. Why am I here? What's the purpose of life? How do I contribute to the world? What's this all about? Becomes an important issue for people. So then dealing with that, trying to resolve these issues and grapple with them, becomes part of the path for people. Related to this is the next stage, which is called purification of knowing. What is the path and what is not the path? This is a hugely important step in Buddhism, because Buddhism is a path practice. It's about being on a path that leads to something. And so to really understand what that path is gives a person a tremendous strength in their life, because then they know where to walk. And the path, and some people it takes a while to figure out what the path is. Just like in other religions, in Buddhism, there's often a wide range of messages about what it's about. It can be confusing, especially in the modern West, where, all the different forms of Buddhism, all not just Buddhism, but all kinds of spiritual traditions, are also easily accessible. All you have to do is go into a bookstore. And, I think I'd like to read a spiritual book. And a few hundred years ago, you'd have to walk, if you could read, you had to walk maybe to the next town and ask someone if they could borrow their one book. And now you go into the bookstore in Barnes & Noble or something, and you have to choose between this wide range of books. And how do you choose, and which one has a teaching that's useful for you? And so it takes a while to find out what the path is. And so that's, an endeavor that takes a while. It helps a lot, at least from a Buddhist point of view, that you know yourself really, really, really well. Because in Buddhism, the path is not found externally, but because of this internalization movement of Buddhism, the path is actually found inside of yourself. There is no path apart from you walking it. There is no path besides seeing it, how it operates in your own heart and your mind and how you behave there. So then it goes on, and I'll stop kind of and list now. But I'm trying to give you a sense of, you know, different people are at different stages and different things they're trying to do. Well, we'll go on a little bit more. So the next stage, purification of what's called knowledge and vision of the path, or walking the path. This is where people, once you know what the path is, people begin walking the path, practicing much more seriously and doing the kind of the internal work that meditation practice entails, for example. And when people do a spiritual practice, it often begins to transform the inner life in various ways. And one of the ways it can transform it is that it cultivates different qualities. So certain practices cultivate love. And people on spiritual paths sometimes find it's really wonderful. I look at myself, I feel all this love that I didn't feel before. It can cultivate a sense of tremendous peace. It can cultivate a tremendous sense of attention or awareness, cultivate a sense of tremendous resolve or energy. Sometimes people get visions inside of beautiful light, kind of meditation. Meditators sometimes have this great, well, sometimes small and vague, but sometimes very strong experiences of light, yellow light, white light, some of the different colored light, that can seem very meaningful because sometimes it comes along with the mind being very concentrated and very peaceful. And people go, wow, this is great. Tremendous feelings of equanimity. There can be experiences of tremendous knowledge. Just the mind just works so clearly and crisply, like you've never done this before. And everything you turn your attention to, you understand in some deep way, meaningful way right now. It's like you just think you're hot stuff because there's such good knowledge. So these things happen for some people as they walk the path. And why it's important, what happens is people will take those experiences or those qualities that get strong, I think that's it. This is what it's all about. It's about having a particular kind of experience. It's about having a particular kind of inner qualities that have become really strong. And that's what it's about. But in the story, you know, Sariputta said, is it about purification of vision and knowledge of walking the path? And the guy said, no, it's not about that. And sometimes for Buddhist teachers like myself, it can be a little bit hard to get people unattached, to disattach themselves from their clinging to meditation experiences and to qualities of inner life, of character that become strong. Especially it's hard when people, I mean, one of the reasons it's hard is that many times Buddhist teachers will emphasize how important it is to develop peace and calm and resolve and good energy and good understanding. And, you know, it's all these things that we're kind of emphasize as being important. So finally they happen, and then you're telling, now you tell me to kind of, don't hold on to them. Don't cling. You know, that doesn't seem quite right. And so they have a role, these things, these qualities and these states. They're not to be dismissed, but they're not to be clung to. And so part of the role of a Buddhist teacher, meditation teacher, is to kind of push people beyond their clinging to these kinds of states. And then as these things go along, we have this experience of nirvana. And nirvana is in some ways the great mystery, you know, for some people. Some people have a clear sense of what it is. But if you go and study in the Buddhist traditions in Southeast Asia, you find in different countries and different monasteries that teachers there who are quite genuine, have had deep form of practice, and I'm sure are quite convinced that they've experienced something like nirvana, but they have a different description of what that is. They don't all agree on what it is. Not only don't they agree, but they'll say, I can't believe the guy down the road. You know, that person, you know, has the wrong nirvana. We have the right nirvana. But as if nirvana is a thing, and some people have this. Some people are very keen on practicing meditation in a very strong way, and having it lead to a particular experience. If I have that, an experience, the right experience, I'll live happily ever after. And it has to be this nirvana experience. But what if nirvana is not an experience? And you're huffing and puffing looking for an experience. Then you're looking for the wrong thing. Maybe it's not about an experience. So what's it about? So I think it's fair to say that in teachings of the Buddha, there are experiences to be had along the way. There are tasks to be fulfilled along the way, like cleaning up your act, healing the mind, overcoming your existential doubts, overcoming, becoming clear about what the path is. There's definitely tasks along the way, but those are not the purpose of it all. Those are just kind of aids and supports along the way. What is the purpose? Where is it supposed to lead to? If it's not going to be an experience, and some people really want experience because then they feel like they can be sure about it. If they have a clear, definitive experience, they can be super confident they got it. And getting it is really important, right? Because until you get it, you're not quite a full Buddhist citizen, right? And you want to be like a full Buddhist citizen. You want to be the most spiritual person on your block. Not any of you, of course. I'm just talking generically. Generally, so. But what if the point is not to have an experience? Maybe the point is not even to have an insight. Maybe the point is not even to have an understanding. All those things can happen. But what is the point? As I read the teachings of the Buddha, the point is to have an inner change, an inner purification, an inner change where you no longer cling to things. You no longer get attached to things. You no longer get shackled or oppressed by the inner life, by anything. The inner life, the mind, has become free and is no longer, you can't oppress it. You can't oppress it by yourself. And no one else can oppress it from outside because the inner life has become free and set free. And it's that freedom from which is important, not the attainment. So it's a little bit, it's a little bit like if there's two people in jail, they've been in jail for a long time, and then they get released from jail, at the same time, same day. The experience of being released is the same. The prison doors open up and they walk out. That they have in common. But what their experience of freedom is like after they've walked through the prison gates can vary dramatically depending on where they go and what they do. The experience of freedom as an experience might be very different from different people. So that if someone relies on their experience of freedom, its definition of what freedom is, it might not be valid for someone who's taken a different road after they left prison. Once you've been released from your clinging, people might take, the way that's experienced might be different for different people depending on many, many different things. So you want to be very careful not to measure yourself against someone else's experience. So what's the measure for this inner change that Buddhism emphasizes? So here, the Buddha gives an interesting list. And he talks about 10 things that the name of the is samyojana in Pali, which literally means, usually translated as fetters, which, how often do you use the word fetter? It's probably just as well translated into English as knots. Like we all knotted up. I was all knotted up inside. And so Buddhism sees that everyone's, until you're fully liberated, people are knotted up inside. And so there's 10 knots that are used to measure this, what you're released from. What you're released into, the Buddha's kind of quiet and silent about that because, you might go different roads after being released. But so there's 10 things that you get unknotted from. And the first three are the easiest. And because they're mostly having to do with understanding. They're more cognitive in a sense, though they're quite profound. And the very first one is no longer succumbing, no longer being attached to the personality view, which means no longer succumbing to any stories, that any story you make up about yourself is truly who you are. that you don't make up a story. This is who I absolutely truly am. So, you know, so there's all kinds of stories we make about ourselves. But one of the stories that you can make up about yourself is that you're enlightened. But the first experience of awakening or freedom is to stop making any stories about who you are. So there's something fishy about someone who gets enlightened and says they are. It isn't exactly wrong to say it. I'm not going to say that it's wrong, but there's something kind of, it's not quite kosher. Because it kind of, if the person really had that shift inside, where you realize that any kind of story I make about myself is not quite it, not really who I am, you know, it's a little bit odd to kind of talk about it that way. So people who have some kind of deep spiritual transformation and have to prove it to everyone else, they probably have a little more work to do. So the first one is, the tendency for human beings to make up stories, to have ideas and beliefs about who I am, their self-identity issues, are really profound, really deeply seated. And it makes sense because part of what we do as we grow up and develop is we have to figure out how we're different than everybody else and how we negotiate, don't bump into people. How when we have an itch, we scratch ourselves and not the neighbor. It's a big deal to kind of make our way through this world and do it successfully. And so having a sense of self, having an understanding of who I am here versus other people out there is part of the developmental task. But there's so many things that influence that developmental task and they make them quite, it gets quite complicated. Sometimes it gets quite dysfunctional. And so part of the story people make up for themselves are can be about comparisons. They're comparing themselves to other people. We tell ourselves stories about who we are that's mostly in relationship to other people's stories about themselves. And so we see ourselves mirrored in the lives of other people, how other people see us. And this whole movement of being in relationship to people and only understanding ourselves in relationship and who likes us and doesn't like us and, you know, is an important thing for some people have to work through. I don't want to belittle it, but it belongs to this category of being involved in personality stories. Make some sense? And so the shift that happens is there's a kind of release that can happen in the heart and the mind, some freedom that could, where we feel or see or experience or somehow realize that that is a prison. Maybe that's too derogatory, but that's a limitation. And there is a way of being unlimited by that. And that unlimited quality, it doesn't make sense to say, this is my unlimited quality. You don't make a story about it. The second of these releasing is clinging to what's usually called rules and observances. I like to translate it as precepts and religious practices because it's a little more inclusive and includes the Buddhists. Usually the Buddhists say it's just other people who do this rules and observances because we don't, of course, are not attached to our practices. But I've known a lot of Buddhists who are pretty attached to their practices. And so practices and rituals and rules, precepts, are important parts of life and they shouldn't be thrown away. But to cling to them is a problem. And to cling to them as being the absolute, is the purpose of the spiritual life is to live by the precepts, follow particular religious observances, from a Buddhist point of view, misses the point because that itself is not the path to freedom, where there is internal releasing that has to happen. So it's not a dismissing of the role of rules and observances and religious practices in people's lives, but it's just not taking them too seriously. Not getting attached to them. And the third one of these cognitive shifts is freedom from doubt. Because once a person has had a full enough movement of release, once they stepped out of prison clearly enough, then they know that freedom is found outside the prison walls. Before that, they might have thought, they just have to rearrange the furniture in the prison, and then everything would be okay. But, you know, then you're still in prison. So once you've stepped out of the prison, you really know. So the issue here is that you're just given a little bit of probation. And so you might, you've been allowed to leave prison for a while, but then we go back in. But now we've been so changed, we know there is something outside. And so when we have this release happens in the heart and the mind clearly enough, then even though we might go back into holding on to things, we're not going to be fooled again. We know that where the path is. We have no, there's no more any doubt. The next two of these fetters, of these knots, how we knot it up, are much more difficult to overcome because they're emotional, or affective, they usually say. And so the first three are cognitive understandings. The next three have to do with affective changes in us. And it has to do with, first, the lessening of sensual desire, attachment to sensual desire, and the lessening of ill will or hostility, anger. And so it's interesting, these are paired with each other. So there's attachment to sensual desire. Attachment to desire is a huge part of human life, and people get in trouble because of it, and there's can be a lot of clinging there. And so to begin that shift that involves letting go of that, first diminishing that, is not so easy. And having released the first three doesn't mean that a person has managed to release their desire, their greed, or their ill will, or their hostility, or something. And so then the next period of time in practice involves this deeper, in the psyche, deeper work of reaching deeper into the places where we get caught up in desire, where we get caught up in anger, and beginning somehow. First it gets lessened. The usual way is it usually lessens slowly, thins out, quiets, until such a time, where the tradition claims, that desire, sensual desire, and ill will no longer operate. The person has been released from them. The last five are considered the most difficult of the knots to unknot. Though the first two, maybe many of you never realized that that it could ever be an issue for you, because you didn't. The first one is clinging to deep states of absorption, deep states of meditation, that still involves being connected to your body, in a sense. And the second is deep attachment to meditation experiences that where the body disappears. It's called formless experience. So because these are so pleasurable and so compelling, some people will take these as absolute, ultimate, and get very attached to them. The next one is very interesting, because remember, the first one was overcoming the personality stories we tell ourselves. The eighth of these knots is conceit. So it's easier to no longer believe that in these stories we tell ourselves about who we are than it is to overcome conceit. Because conceit is a deeply rooted kind of emotional movement that people have. It's considered one of the last things in Buddhism that, as you mature into the Buddhist practice, one of the last things that's let go of because it's so hard and so tenacious. And the conceit involves a number of things. Broadly, it involves comparing yourself to people at all, any kind of way at all. Comparing yourself as being better than other people, that you're worse than other people, and also the comparison where you say you're equal to other people. So what's left? And what's left is don't play the comparison game. Because as long as you're in that game of comparing yourself to other people, you can't really be free. And unfortunately, our society does a lot of comparing for us. So it's a difficult task somehow to overcome also the lessons of society that does these painful comparisons. But the idea is to learn to not have any kind of conceit, including that you're less than. in Buddhism, that's considered a kind of conceit too. But more subtly, conceit also means the subtle, maybe not so subtle sense of the personality story involves a sentence, I am X, I am something. There's a more subtle conceit in Buddhism which doesn't have an X, just a sense of I am, M-ness. And some people, it's very compelling, the sense of non-dualistic M-ness, kind of holistic sense of beingness, sense of being without being anything in particular. But that sense of there is an I that am in Buddhism still involves a kind of clinging. And if you really want to be free fully, you let go of that as well. And then the final one, the ninth one is restlessness. There's something about the mind being restless that is one of the last things to be released in this whole path of freedom. Because to be really be free, the mind can't go out towards anything, whether it goes out towards or away from anything. And wanting to think, even to think about something, the mind is going towards what we're trying to think about. Or if we don't want like something, the mind kind of pulls away from it. And that's a kind of restlessness, an agitation of the mind. And so a very, very deep peace and settledness of the mind only happens when the restlessness is released. And then the final of these fetters is ignorance. And they say you don't really understand what it's all about until you've released the last of the fetters. And so with a complete release, then ignorance is dissolved or let go of. So the definition of, the classic definition of the purpose of what this is all about is not in an experience, is not in qualities of character, not in integrity, it's not in meditation experiences, it's not in certain feelings and states that can arise, but it's classically defined by what we're freed from, what we're released from. And then once you've been released, what then? Some people don't like the fact that it's stated negatively, just the absence of something. They want their religion to be positive. You know, something great that you can hold up, you know, as a trophy or something. And the answer to what's next once you've been released, perhaps that's up to you. Once you have no more hang-ups, what are you going to do with your life? And so maybe there's something very important about leaving that for you rather than reading a book from Buddhism that says, once you're free, you should be this way. Once you're free from prison, this is what you should be doing. Who knows what you should do with your freedom? But it's pretty good to get free. And my belief is that once you're free, once you release these deep-seated attachments that function at the foundation, kind of like the foundation stones that support the edifice of our life, once those foundations have dissolved or been fallen away, that then our life can be a wonderful gift in one way or the other to the world that we live in. But who knows what form that'll take. And maybe the world will never have seen before your particular version of freedom. May you each enjoy yourself as you set yourself free. So I hope this has made sense. Thank you.